Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Freeform, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Tom Hartmann, internationally syndicated talk show host, about the newest book in his Hidden History series, The Hidden History of American Democracy. And having read this one, I'd recommend them all. You can learn more at tomhartmann.com. And catch the spelling here. It's TomHartmann. TomHartmann.com. On Freeform, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, provocative, innovative approaches to politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. This show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I shared some of the surprising information in The Hidden History of American Democracy with four of my brothers and sisters on our weekly family Zoom this weekend, and they were as excited as I was to learn that Enlightenment thinkers might trace some of their ideas from Native Americans and the provocative inferences that one can make from that. And I told them about the popularity and influence of books chronicling the political systems of some of America's natives, and the quotes that Tom includes of their writings and exchanges among the European intelligentsia and their counterparts across the Atlantic, Jefferson, Franklin, John Adams, even Thomas Paine, extolling the virtues of the Native Americans' model of society. He writes on page one, as Europeans began driving deep into the American landscape throughout the 17th and early 18th centuries, stories began to trickle back to Europe about people who had figured out how to live in civilized society without the chains of oppression, both political and religious, that were the hallmarks of that era. So that's page one, and that sets us into the first section of the book, which is really a wonderful revelation to me. I'd heard about the Iroquois Confederacy having an influence on the American Constitution, but Tom's book really brings it home in wonderful detail. When I finished sharing some of the highlights, my sister, who lives in Atlanta and is quite politically active, said, well, I'm afraid those secrets are going to stay hidden. I think what she meant was that if I was just finding out some of this, and they, who are curious, well-read folks, were just finding it out, that most of this knowledge might remain hidden from most people. And we also all agreed, having been lucky enough or old enough to have had civics courses in our youth, we had learned about the three co-equal branches of government and the founders' design of checks and balances, both of which Tom reveals are nowhere to be found in the Constitution. And he points out, however, the Constitution at the very least suggests, by the order in which they appear in the document, that Congress comes first, followed by the executive, and then the courts. This is also the order of how democratic they each are, how representative they are of we the people. And when my sibs asked me how Tom sees us reclaiming the fuller democracy of the Native Americans or of the founders, I pointed them to part four, a 21st century democratic agenda, where he lists 21 actions, including making voting a right instead of a privilege, regulating the Supreme Court, expanding the Senate by adding states, etc. And their basic response was, those are great policies, but how in the hell is any of that going to happen? And they obviously were hoping for strategies, tactics, way of shifting the exercise of power in ways that might make these things possible. The only one of Tom's recommended actions that responds to that question is number 21, get involved. It felt like he'd offered us a treasure map, and we felt that we had no way to get to the island where the treasure existed. But I realized he could answer, well, wait, you could take a boat, a raft, a plane, a helicopter. And I think that's a lot like America. It's not impossible that we could vote in different people and change the rules. It just feels that way. So there's a lot to talk about, a lot to learn here. And I'm struck by, Tom, I'm struck by the value of the two very different sections in the book, parts one to three, the history, especially the role played by Native American political society, And then part four, the prescription for actions to take. And since we've got limited time and the hidden history is harder to find, let's focus on that. I would love to do another one of these in the future where we brief the history and focus on the agenda. So Tom Hartman is an internationally syndicated talk show host whose show is available in over 500 million homes worldwide, the best-selling author of 24 books. A few of them were sort of groundbreaking on attention deficit disorder and sparked a national debate on ADD. And another, Rebooting the American Dream, was delivered by Bernie Sanders to his 99 Senate colleagues and quoted at length by Bernie on the floor of the Senate in his famous filibuster. Others include The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight on Climate Change, highly recommended, and 10 so far in the Hidden History series, including Hidden History of American Healthcare, Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment, Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America. And we're talking here today about the 10th, The Hidden History of American Democracy, Rediscovering Humanity's Ancient Way of Living. Welcome, Tom Hartman, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Well, thanks, Terrence. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor.
And let me tell people that this conversation is on Tuesday, July 11th. I always start with this question so folks get, they can read your books, they can watch your shows. How did you end up where you are today when you look at how did you become today's Tom Hartman doing what today's Tom Hartman does?
Well, that's a good question. I think most of it has been kind of reactive. In the 90s, my son was diagnosed with ADHD, and I thought the diagnosis was destructive the way it was presented to him. And so I went on a research binge and came up with this theory of ADHD as, you know, genetically hunters and farmers, and wrote a book about it, and it became a bestseller. In the late 90s, early 2000s, as the George Bush phenomena was coming along, I started writing about politics explicitly, mostly for commondreams.org. And in 2002, in December 2002, I published a piece called Talking Back to Talk Radio, which, because I used to work in radio. My first real job, I was 16. I got a job as a weekend DJ in a country western station. And I worked in radio and radio news for a decade. And, you know, I thought that there was a way that you could actually make money doing progressive talk radio. There, you know, the country's 50-50. Why do we have 1,500 conservative stations and not a single progressive one at that time outside of the Pacifica network, which was pretty dysfunctional? And so I wrote this op-ed, and it became the business plan for Air America Radio. You know, the people who started Air America read my article and called me up, flew me out to Chicago. And so then I started my program as proof of concept. I had sold a business and retired and had some spare time and thought, you know, what the hell? I used to do radio. And if I can make this successful, it'll show other people that it can work. And so even this was a year before Air America got off the ground, I started the program in Montpelier, Vermont, and in my living room. And within a year, had it on 27 stations and a small network that was owned by the UAW and on Sirius satellite radio. And you know, it was never intended to be a big project or a business. I was retired. I had sold a business. I thought I was just going to, you know, write books and have a good time and travel. And it's turned into this beast. It's consumed my life for 20 years now. But, you know, I'm having a good time. So I guess the short answer to your question is I've been reacting to things rather than sitting around deciding, you know, what the big scheme is going to be.
Right. By the way, I will say that I have asked that question of many people of great achievement and all of that, and almost all of them say basically that. Reactive, improv, that sort of thing. The whole model of pick it out when you're, you know, 15 and go straight ahead is not how it usually happens.
Yeah, unless you're going to go to medical school or something.
You know? Right, right.
Career, that makes sense, but I haven't had a career. I've had a hodgepodge of occupations.
So why the Hidden History series?
I wanted, when we originally came up with this idea and pitched it to my book agent, Bill Gladstone, the idea was, Louise called them rainy day books. That was our original idea. And I got the idea actually from Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky wrote, a number of, he's a linguist, and he wrote a bunch of books on language, and he wrote a couple of political books that were pretty thoughtful, but they were like 500-page books, you know, and they were dense and they were hard to read. And he had a very small but fervent following that I was among. And then a small publishing company out of New York got permission from him to essentially excerpt his books. And they came up with a series of short books on individual topics. And each one was about 60 pages. And it was the company was like 10 windows, 4 doors or something.
I have a number of those books. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know what I'm talking about. And those books just exploded, you know, and that's what made Noam Chomsky famous, was those little books. And it wasn't that I was looking for something to make me famous, but I did get that, you know, if you want to reach a lot of people, particularly in this era of the internet and all these distractions that we're surrounded with, that you can't do it with a 600-page book. And so the proposal was to write a series of books dealing with topics having to do with American democracy and our American form of government, that, one topic per book. And each book could be read in a, you know, on a rainy day, you know, or on a weekend. None of them are longer than 160 pages, basically, of content.
Right.
And
by the way, I see the bookcases behind you, and I have not in, I actually record in a closet because the clothes baffle so well. It's good for the sound quality, but my office has floor to ceiling bookcases. But boy, when I saw that yours was 145 pages, basically, I just loved it.
Yeah, yeah. And for me, it was a great relief. You know, I've written a lot of, 200, 300, 350-page books. And very often, you've got a publisher who wants to buy a 90,000-word book. And you can really deliver your message in 40,000 words. And you end up, you know, filling the book with examples and redundancies and with these little books, there's none of that. It's all, you know, there's no fat, it's all meat. And it was really refreshing to be able to write tight and to the point. So I think they're more readable, frankly, as a result of that. And they were certainly easier to write.
Right. Well, with condensing things and concision is a challenge. We know that. But still, I don't want any of my other guests to hear me say this. But usually the first two or three chapters, the last one, that's
you've
the
got the
book.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually. We all learned that in high school, right? If you're going to do a book report.
Exactly. You read
the first two pages of every chapter and read the first two chapters and the last two chapters.
Yeah. And all the work they put into that middle part. Okay. Why this one? And the particular slant you take, in other words, I can certainly see at this time of what I would consider endangered democracy, writing about American democracy, but the particular slant you take with your subtitle about, the ancient wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple of myths around our democracy that I wanted to blow up. In fact, there's a number of them that I wanted to blow up, you know, this push for theocracy, the stuff about, you know, guns and the Second Amendment, although I wrote an entire hidden history book about that one. But the main one was the idea that democracy is not a normal thing, that it's something that some smart European thought up 3,000 years ago in Greece, and Aristotle blew it up, and, you know, it was a failed experiment. But hey, maybe we could make it work here in America if we try real hard, because it just really requires smart people. And that's kind of meritocratic argument is really an argument against democracy. It's an argument for an elite governing class, and the foundation of a lot of conservative philosophy. Whereas democracy is the opposite of that. Democracy is the wisdom of the crowd. It's that the largest number of people participating in decision making almost always guarantees the very best, most resilient decisions. And in fact, there was a fascinating study that was published in Nature just last week or the week before last of some new archaeological work that's been done in Mesoamerica, where they found that those communities, that there's all these communities in Central America that are were not dictatorial, that were run in ways that we're now looking at the arc. And some of these are communities of 100,000, 200,000 people.
Right, right. This is not just little gatherings.
Right. No, and it's literally no evidence of poverty and no evidence of great wealth. And these were, you know, run democratically, small d democratically, as opposed to like the Incas and the Mayans and their imitators that were basically dictatorships. And what they found was that those democratically run communities were more resilient when it came to everything from droughts and floods to disease to attack by non-democratic communities that were, you know, trying to steal their resources. And so democracy, and that's why, you know, I tell the whole story in the book about the biology of democracy, the story of the red deer, that virtually every animal species, from ants to gorillas, does group decision making through democracy, 50% plus one. And when there's a risk, when there's a predator around, for example, it amps up to around 2/3 plus one. Which, by the way, both are exist in our Constitution.
Right.
This is and this is something that, although science is only now proving it, you know, that school of fish, you know, I always thought they were telepathic. How does that entire school make a left turn all at once? Well, it turns out with every fin thing or flocks of birds, with every wing beat, they're actually voting, you know, and
right.
When 51% of them move 2 degrees to the right, then the whole school or the whole flock moves to the right. So, you know, this is I think the idea that democracy is the default state for virtually all animal life and important to us as humans, it was a really, really important message to convey. And I wanted to really highlight that in the book. And then, you know, a lot of the solutions come out of that understanding that this really is the way we should live. And therefore, the things that the majority of people want really should, you know, we should be setting our sights at doing. You know, the vast majority of Americans want, you know, free or like low cost healthcare available to everybody in the country. The vast majority of Americans want good quality public education all the way up through PhD and MD at little to no cost. And it's not because people are, you know, want freebies. It's like these should be considered the commons. The vast majority of Americans, I could go on, you know, wants Social Security strengthened and things like that. But we're not getting it. And we're not getting it because we've got basically an oligarchy, you know, right now. Jimmy Carter on my program 7 years ago said America is no longer a democracy. It's an oligarchy because of Citizens United, with unlimited political bribery, Jimmy Carter said. And I point that out in the book, that the Supreme Court, in fact, I wrote a whole book about that too, the hidden history of the Supreme Court and the betrayal of America. But basically, the Supreme Court inserted a cancerous poison into our body politic with their decisions in 78 and the Bilotti decision in 2010 with Citizens United, saying that corporations are people and that money is the same thing as free speech. And, you know, we need to do something about that because it's poisoning America.
Right. Oh, God, I have so many responses. One thing is I want to direct people to a couple of books that make the point about animals, which is Rucker Bregman's Humankind and Brian Hare's Survival of the Friendliest, both which point out cooperation is what animals use for survival, and it actually is why we've achieved as much as we have.
Exactly.
And what you point out about the dictator or the oligarchy is, think about it. If it is truly democratic, then the agenda, the goal, the mission is to achieve what most want. You don't have the side agenda of how do I keep power? How do I pass it on to my children?
Right.
How do I amass wealth?
Yep.
That agenda is off the table. Some of the stuff that was most surprising, I want to make sure we talk about. And as I say, people should definitely check out part four and the actions that actually would bring us toward a democracy that favors well-being for the most. But some of what you learned here in terms of Franklin, Jefferson, Adams, and the European intelligentsia, just a little bit of that, a couple of nuggets of that to whet people's appetite to grab the book.
I think that our history and the way that we've taught civics basically stripped Native Americans out of our national understanding of the founding of this country altogether. and people's understanding of the founders, in fact, was that, you know, they were basically people who lived in a society of white people and enslaved people, and that was it. And in fact, you know, there were Native American communities all around Virginia, you know, at the time of Jefferson and Madison, and all around Massachusetts at the time John Adams was living there, and all around New York when Thomas Paine was there. And so the really important thing, I think, is that people get that this is a healthy, you know, that democracy is a healthy thing, and that the Native Americans, through literally tens of thousands of years of trial and error, had figured this out. It was, you know, this is the result of literally cultural evolution.
These are the tribes that survived.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And therefore we should take their lessons very seriously. And we fail to do so at our own peril.
And that the founders did. And that the European Enlightenment thinkers did.
Yeah. Take them yeah. Seriously. Oh, yeah. Jefferson's father was a map maker in Virginia, and young Thomas used to follow Peter around the state, they would stay with the Indians. His father spoke several Native American languages. John Adams had close friends who were Native Americans, as did Paine, as did George Washington.
Had an official role as commissioner.
For 30 years, Franklin was one of the main people connecting the governments of the United States and the governments of New York State and other states with Native American communities. And these people lived among them. They knew them. They spoke their languages in many cases. And they had tremendous respect for them. So much of that has been stripped out of our national mythology, and certainly out of popular literature and movies and things like that.
Yeah. So I don't think we say it to just glorify or shine a light on the Native Americans and their wisdom, but to show again where we've gone wrong, where we've gone off the path of what supplies well-being to the populace.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like I said, I think that we ignore the lessons of natural selection at our risk.
I think one could safely say that about just about anything.
There you go.
I know you've got to run, so we've got just a couple of more minutes. I'll do my conclusion after you go. But if you can connect the origin stories and the traditions that the Constitution is based on with some of the agenda you think is necessary to actually re-achieve democracy, what I don't think we're going to get to is the other question that my Sibs had, which is, well, wait, how is any of that going to happen in this United States? We'll leave that for another time.
Well, I, you know, my goal with this book was to connect those two things, you know, the where we came from and where we should be going based on this understanding of where we came from and how we got here. In terms of how we're going to bring it about, I am a big fan of Neil Howe's theory of the fourth turning. His new book, The Fourth Turning Is Here, is out this week, actually.
Bill and Strauss was a classmate of mine and a friend for years.
Yeah, I've got a galley of the book right here, and it's brilliant. And then Stanley Turchin, you know, his writings. And Howe is positing these 80-year cycles, 40 years conservative, 40 years liberal, going back and forth. And frankly, I think that we're at the end of the Reagan cycle. It's why the last book was The Hidden History of Neoliberalism and how Reaganism gutted the American middle class. I think that all we have to do is show up. It's not going to require some, you know, well thought out strategy or some secret plan or some, you know, mind boggling template or schematic. We just have to show up, and the times are with us. The generational changes are with us, and the clarity of understanding of the mistakes that were made by the Reaganistas and the people who basically took America off track in 1980 are now undeniable. Ranging from macro stuff like climate change to micro stuff like, making Social Security income taxable. And so, you know, I think that a new day is coming. I really believe this. And the Zoomer generation coming up, you know, they're like our generation was, the boomers. They are very, very aware, very politically active. And frankly, I think they're going to be the salvation of this nation.
And just very quickly to add on to that, and then I'll let you go. They are finding that young people, there was a truism. 35 and up, you started getting more conservative, not necessarily happening to that generation. And so I think if you have seniors upset about Social Security, upset about Medicare, upset about housing, young people upset about student loans, upset about Roe v. Wade, upset about housing, upset about climate change, they're there. And yeah. And as you point out, the mistakes are obvious.
We have a coalition. We have a coalition.
That's right. That's right. So again, the newest book is The Hidden History of American Democracy, Rediscovering Humanity's Ancient Way of Living. And the website is thomhartmann.com. That's thomhartmann.com. I'm going to let you go, Tom. Thank you so much and keep up your good work.
Thanks, Terrence. Great talking with you today. I appreciate the invitation.
For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus 8 to 10 articles I choose each week to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts and at other podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site or most podcast sites. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, @McNallyTerrence. Thanks to Keanu Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.